Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. El Velador, or the Night Watchman, is an eye into the world of Mexico's notorious drug wars, filled with violence, murder, and greed, and the forces behind tens of thousands of deaths. But this story, by Mexican filmmaker Natalia Almada, is told from the perspective of Martin, the man who keeps watch over the elaborate mausoleums where some of Mexico's most infamous drug lords are buried. Martin's words in the film are few.
Cuando hay fiestecillas y que en la noche ve entre una banda así y viene gente que sea armada así, una que otra vez.
Joining us now is director Natalia Almada, whose film El Velador will be screened tonight at the Wexner Center for the Arts. For more information, go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome to the show, Natalia.
Thank you.
I wanted to hear Martin's voice. I wanted listeners to hear his voice, even though most of them probably won't be able to understand it. So translate for our listeners what we just heard and explain what Martin the Night Watchman was talking about.
Sure. Well, I sort of fell in love with Martin because he's this very kind of stoic, quiet character, and his job is just to keep watch over the cemetery. And so I feel like he invites us to watch over the cemetery with him. And the thing he says in the clip you played is people come and they have little parties and they often shoot their guns. And what he's describing is sort of the nightlife of the cemetery, and which is very alive. And it's absolutely as he describes it. So a lot of the people who are buried are quite young, under 30, and their friends come and they have parties and they get drunk and they have the whole Sinaloa banda, which is a very traditional Mexican local kind of music. So it's not at all like your typical cemetery in that way. And that's what he's describing. So for the rest of the film, you kind of slide into the life of the cemetery, which is very quiet and contemplative. And you have the widows during the day and they come with their children who kind of play at the cemetery. And the idea is that through the life of the cemetery, we kind of get a reflection of the violence in Mexico.
The contrast between his hut or his little house and the mausoleums for the dead is absolutely startling. It looks like a little town of beautiful, tiny little churches.
What's one of the things I think that struck me the most when I was shooting is that the construction workers would say, you know, this mausoleum is bigger than my house. And it's true, you know, there's 2-3-story mausoleums. They're quite lavish. You know, they have marble and, you know, fancy ironwork. And a lot of them have air conditioning. And Sinaloa is really, really hot. So that's a big luxury. And so you can understand a little bit the socioeconomic context in which the drug trafficking thrives. And this kind of delinquent behavior that where people can get money fast. And yet you see that they're all dying so young. And I was struck, you know, the cemetery is full of these posters of the deceased. And I'm 37, and I would look at the dates and I would say, oh, well, he's younger than I am and he's younger than I am. And I would notice that most of the people buried were in their early 30s, late 20s.
Sometimes the camera comes to rest on a close-up of one of the dead, a picture of one of them. And I was wondering about that because I couldn't tear my eyes away, and it would rest there for quite some time. And I wondered what your thoughts were about that and what you were thinking when you decided to do something like that.
Well, the film is quite contemplative and meditative and slow, and that's for a few reasons. One is that it is a cemetery and we are looking at death, and so there is something about trying to capture that sense that time has stopped. The other side of it is a little bit more formal in the sense that when you're asked to look at something for a longer period of time, you have time to have different thoughts. You process different things. So first you maybe recognize what it is you're looking at. So you might say, well, this is a young man. It's a poster of a young man. And then you have time to think about what that means and who he was. And so that's a little bit the pacing of the film and the slowness of the film asks us to kind of ask those questions. And for me, the posters of these young men are striking because most of them are cell phone photographs. They're blown up to be a meter and a half, you know, let's say 3-4 feet wide. So they're very big and pixelated and they're young and they're kind of in the prime of their lives. And then you forget in a sense that they have died and that they're buried there.
And we refer to them, so many of them, as drug lords, but they're very young. We don't, we think of some old men somewhere, you know, counting money, and it's not really like that.
Well, I think it's one of the big kind of misconceptions when we think about drug trafficking, and we think all of them are capos. And the truth is that most of the people involved are young men who don't feel that they have other opportunities, and they kind of get seduced into this world because they can make money, they can have luxuries that they otherwise wouldn't be able to afford. And when you see the 23-year-old construction worker making $15 a day and working in the heat and difficult work, it's, I think, understandable how one might get seduced. So I'm not saying that it's right, but it's understandable. And I think it's important to understand that kind of greater social context in which violence thrives.
The radio broadcasts are a big part of the audio for the film. And often we hear about bad weather forecasts immediately before the latest death toll in the drug war. We don't see the carnage in the film, but we definitely hear about it. There's descriptions.
Well, the sound design of the film is something I worked on a lot. And I think one of the things that happens is that when we listen to things, it's the beauty of radio, we really have to engage our imagination. And sometimes what you hear is more powerful than what you see. And what you cannot see can be more frightening than what you actually can see. So the fear of the dark, for example, right? And the radio, it was a way to give context to the place. And so you're in the cemetery, but you hear what's happening outside the cemetery through the coconut driver with his radio, the news at night.
Let's listen to another little segment from the film. At one point, we see the cemetery by day busy with workers building those elaborate monuments to these fallen drug lords, all while their families grieve as well. That scene really gives you that paradoxical feel of living among the dead and also a sense of business as usual, and no matter how unusual the business might be.
It's a very moving scene. I think in some ways it's the most emotional scene in the film. And you don't see the mother. You just hear her off screen. And actually, tonight at the Wexner, we're also going to show my first film. That's a short film called All Water Has a Perfect Memory. That's about the death of my sister. And at the end, my mother says, you know, I wailed because every mother's wail has always sounded the same. And for me, the cry of the mother in El Velador is that kind of universal wail that a mother has when she loses her child. And so I think it's something that kind of can touch everybody in the sense that you for a moment suspend that kind of moral judgment that we always attach to drug trafficking and the drug war and all this violence. And you say, wait a minute, these are actually people with children and mothers and not so different than I am, just a different set of circumstances.
In a synopsis of the film, I read that the code of silence makes conversation dangerous and that the word narco is forbidden. Is the code of silence part of the reason why Martin, we don't hear much from Martin and you don't, he doesn't say much?
Well, as a documentary filmmaker, you know, when I started, and the way we usually make films is you take your camera and you start to interview people and you ask them questions and you think that how they describe their lives and their testimony is actually going to be the way that we understand what they're experiencing and the circumstances. At the cemetery, this proved to be useless because when I would ask people questions, they couldn't really answer. And the asking of those direct questions, you know, like who's buried here and how much did this mausoleum cost and, you know, what did the person do, puts everybody in a precarious situation. And so nobody actually can speak with freedom. And I think that this is one of the very important results of violence is that people are forced into silence and people can't really say what their circumstances are, what they fear, you know, what they've done. There's this silence that kind of dictates the situation. And once I understood that, I realized that it was through action and gesture that we could tell the story and that it was the only way to understand what's really happening.
And I was surprised, too, just as they were afraid to say anything, I was wondering about your own fears about being there.
you know, it's also given that in Mexico right now, so many journalists are being killed.
Right.
The moment you're working in Mexico, dealing with the violence with a camera, you're kind of considered a journalist. So it is a dangerous situation, I think, for anybody who's making work, whether it's, you know, we have great artists making work about the violence and journalists, people on TV, radio. That said, I think I was really lucky because the construction workers in Martin really took care of me. And I have an assistant in Culiacan, someone I've known my whole life, who's works on the ranch. He's not a filmmaker, but he was with me.
You're from the ranch. It's where you're from.
He's from where I'm from. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, is a woman. Also, it's a bit of a strange position to be in. So it was important to have this man with me.
Right.
With a big truck. You know.
The construction workers were really interesting. I enjoyed hearing them chatter among themselves, even though they were talking about the dead and passing judgment on them to a certain degree. But it felt kind of normalizing a little bit. It felt a little more like something I could understand.
It's strange because the normalizing of violence, I think you really see it in two moments. You see it with the construction workers and how they talk about the news, in this case of the death of one of the big drug lords, and how it's going to affect them and whether it's true or not. Mm-hmm. And the other area in which I think you see it a lot is with the widows. And they go to the cemetery and they clean the tombs, and their kids especially, they kind of play as if they were, you know, in their backyards or at home. And there's something so tragic when you see those little children, you know, playing on tombs, and you think, how is it, what's their future going to be if this is what's normal to them today?
Who pays for those mausoleums? How much do they cost? It's hard to describe, and I certainly recommend anybody, you know, you can of course check out a trailer and that'll help a little bit, but the film at the Wexner Center tonight is certainly worth considering. You can go to our website at WOSU.org and get more information about that, but they're very elaborate, as you mentioned, and who pays for that? Is it their legacy? I mean, is it something their family pays for? Or?
It's not entirely clear who pays for it. It is a private cemetery, and so to buy your plot there is expensive. So we already know that it's a certain, you know, people with certain dispensable income who can be there. What gets built on top of the actual plot, the grave, that is up to each individual family. And so whether it's someone who has the resources while they're alive and builds the mausoleum for the family, that's one situation. Or if it's the widow who builds the mausoleum for her husband, that's another situation. But I shot there in 2004 the first time, and the mausoleums that looked big in 2004 look tiny today. It's just exploded. I mean, not only have they had to dig new holes for more bodies to expand the, you know, the overall size of the cemetery, but the mausoleums themselves just get bigger and more lavish and more creative. And I think when you first see them, and for me, first going there and seeing these mausoleums, it's very easy to kind of dismiss them as kitsch and grandiose, and then kind of think, oh, these are, you know, displays of power and they're encouraging violence. And I'm not going to say that's none of that's true, but I think what's more interesting that you get over time is that I think most of us have this desire to be remembered once we've died, and to think that our lives mattered and that the people who remain once we're gone will have a place to mourn us and will remember us and continue, give our life meaning in a sense. And I think that's what's quite beautiful about the cemetery, is that you see these people who've died so young, and so in a way they have to say, my life did matter. And the mausoleum is that. It's saying, I may have died young, but my life mattered, and my friends are still going to celebrate me and be with me and make parties and have the music and all these things around me.
Just to give people some perspective, when you started filming, four mausoleums were under construction and a new hole had just been dug for 300 more graves. And by the time you finished filming, the graves were filled. That hole was filled.
Yes. Well, also when I started filming, it was 2009, I think about 18,000 people had been killed at that time. And today people say it's up to 60,000.
Yeah, it's between 37 and 53 or 60,000. It's pretty amazing. How has the film been received in Mexico?
It's been more in the festival circuit in Mexico mm-hmm. so far. We'll have our theatrical release in November. But what's great or interesting when you make films is that when you show them abroad or show them in the country where they're shot, people respond so differently because yeah. in one, they see themselves reflected. And so it's like looking in the mirror and you say, well, is the reflection I see the way I imagine myself or not? So it's a much more committed and engaged audience in that sense, but also an audience that has a preconception that's a lot stronger than the one a foreign audience has. What's wonderful for me has been to show the film in places where there is violence. And then it becomes much more abstract and it becomes much more theoretical about what does it mean to live in these situations of violence, and less specific, but actually more emotional, perhaps.
Well, I want to thank you for joining me today, Natalia Almada, a filmmaker. Her film is called El Velador, or The Night Watchman. It's about the world, the afterworld, I guess, in a sense, of Mexico's notorious drug wars. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And the film's being screened at the Wexter tonight. You can check that out on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Yeah?
And it will also have its broadcast premiere tomorrow night, the 27th, on POV.
Okay, a point of view on public television. Check that out, too. Thanks again. We'll be right back and talk about the latest in the war with the Mexican bureau chief for McClatchy Newspapers. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm General Manager Tom Ryland, congratulating the WOSU News Team for being named the best radio news operation in Ohio and for winning Best Radio News Website. Hear more from our news team on 89.7 NPR News and online anytime at WOSU.org.
And it's 66 degrees in downtown Columbus. Showers and thunderstorms likely off and on throughout the day, a high of 74. There's a chance of rain still tonight, a low of 55 degrees. Cloudy with still that chance of rain on Thursday, a high of 69. Support for 89.7 comes from Green Bean Delivery, offering home delivery of fresh organic produce and natural groceries, striving to make healthy eating more accessible to the communities of Greater Columbus. Details on Green Bean Delivery's products, as well as how to place an order, can be found online at greenbeandelivery.com. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The Mexican drug cartel stories conjure images of murders and unspeakable violence. And despite efforts by the Mexican government and President Felipe Calderon, more than 47,000 people have died in Mexican drug violence since 2006. Tim Johnson, Mexico City Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers, joins us now from Mexico to talk about that. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Thank you very much, Ian.
You wrote last week that the Los Zetas crime gang has turned to jailbreaks to replenish its troops. And that really struck me as a sign of the times. I wondered, are they running that short of warm bodies?
Are they running, I'm sorry?
Running that short of warm bodies. I mean, are they running out of help? Okay.
Well, I mean, you know, first of all, the estimates of how many people may be involved in some aspect, directly or indirectly, of the drug trade in Mexico is astounding. I mean, you know, as many as 500,000 people
right.
may be relying on, you know, proceeds, drug profits. You know, they could be neighborhood watch people, you know, just eyes and ears of the drug gangs to accountants to all sorts of people. Yes, they are running short of bodies in certain areas of the country because there's so much violence between rival gangs. And so it's much easier to get 50 people or 100 people out of jail who've already been trained than to have to recruit new people and train them. That takes a long time.
Are they more at war with each other than they are with the government, or is it pretty much all the same to them?
No, I think it's pretty clear that they're more at war with each other over drug trafficking routes, turf for other criminal activity. It can be human smuggling, piracy of DVDs, extortion, kidnapping, all that sort of thing. The panorama, the criminal panorama in Mexico changes constantly as gangs get stronger and grow weaker. And so over the 2.5 years I've been here, we've seen the big industrial city of Monterrey get really enveloped in a very serious crime wave. And more recently, that's diminished a bit. But then the crime has moved to other areas of the country. Guadalajara right now has probably 6 different crime groups battling out, control of areas of that city. And that's a very large city.
Between the cartels and this, do they differ in demeanor? Do they differ in style? Are there, for instance, Robin Hood cartels out there or others that just take and don't give? Is there a sense about differences between them?
There are really significant differences in how some of them go about business. I've been in Latin America for, some 20 years in various places, including in Colombia, and I wouldn't describe any of them as real Robin Hood cartels. The Zetas is a criminal band that's known for particularly brutal enforcement of its control. So they're the ones that would do really, very rampant beheadings and hangings of victims from bridges and that sort of thing. The Sinaloa cartel, which is run by, probably one of the world's richest men, that is Joaquin Shorty Guzman, is considered more of a crime group that would rather pay off people than kill them, although they've done some very brutal things, including unleashing a war in Ciudad Juarez, the city right across from El Paso, that left more than probably 11,000 dead just in that city alone. So there's no good guys in this in the Mexican underworld.
The jailbreaks, going back to that, they occur pretty much in concert with wardens and guards, another indication that local authorities are often corrupted, I guess. The national government has boasted that its military will do the jobs, and polls have shown that the people trust the military more. And I was wondering, is there any sense about how long that will last?
Well, it's a complicated issue because soldiers and Marines are not trained to gather evidence. And if they don't gather evidence, then they can't prosecute. And if they can't prosecute, then there's impunity, and it becomes an endless cycle. In certain areas of the country, the soldiers, the Mexican army, has a good reputation, but they've also been accused of human rights abuses. And here's the most important issue: the Mexican army has not proven itself capable of attacking drug gangs, probably because of corruption within its own ranks. Mm-hmm. So, that's putting the Mexican army in charge is basically saying this would go on forever. The Mexican Navy has shown a much more, although a smaller force, is won the trust of U.S. officials and has taken down a number of drug lords very successfully.
I think it was in July that you wrote that more than 260 aerospace companies now operate in Mexico, exporting $4.3 billion in aircraft and parts last year alone. And the Mexican government set a target of $12 billion in such exports by 2020, a figure that would surpass aerospace exports from Brazil and Spain, which is amazing. Yeah. That seems such an odd contrast to this almost medieval violence of the cartel wars.
Yeah, and that goes partly to the way life is in Mexico now. So much of the violence is really concentrated in specific areas and is, as we talked earlier, is sort of, cartel on cartel or drug gang on drug gang violence. And so you do have these clusters like this aerospace cluster in Querétaro, mm-hmm. a city that's about 2.5-3 hours north of Mexico City. You also have Tijuana, that's got a rather amazing collection of factories that do, for instance, they're among the world leaders in medical devices. And the Mexican auto industry is really doing very well, exporting a huge number of cars. I think they're fourth largest exporter of cars now in the world. At least that's what President Calderon has said in recent weeks. So, you know, you've got probably more than $10 billion worth of investment announced by big global auto makers in new investments in Mexico coming online within the next couple, 3 years. It's in many ways, Mexico's future looks pretty good economically. They're going to grow 4% this year, and they've had a rough past 5 or 6 years, partly because of the global recession. But the wages now in Mexico are comparable to wages in China, if you include wages and all benefits. And so, global manufacturers are thinking, gosh, you know, we don't need to have our products tied up on ships for 2 months crossing the Pacific if we can get them in 2 weeks, on the bridge in Laredo. So it's changing the dynamic a little bit of global trade.
But is it changing the dynamic of the drug wars in Mexico? Some people have thought, well, if we could just improve the economy, get better jobs for people, there wouldn't be these 500,000 people out there dependent on the cartels for a job. And yet that's not necessarily been the case. It gets worse.
Well, here's the fact that the Mexican government, while it's been very good on the macroeconomic level and it's bringing in this foreign investment and there are these clusters, wages aren't going up. Hmm. And there's not been a concerted effort by this federal government of Mexico to say, hey, we want standards of living to generally, you know, improve, even if slowly, so that domestic consumption grows and we buy more and people's lives are better. And so that's the concern about the sort of economic model in Mexico, is that, yes, it's bringing in more foreign investment. Yes, there's more factories. There are plenty of engineers being graduating from Mexican universities. But wages have been stuck at a very a low level for a long time, and there's no sign that there's, you know, anything to do to improve that.
I was in Mexico City and I was interviewing a banker, and I was asking him, why is there so much rebar in Mexico? Why don't they ever finish building their houses? And he said, well, it's because of credit. The credit, there's never been easy credit in Mexico. It's not easy to, no matter how much you make, get credit there. That's a big factor. And I was wondering if that was still the case, because that was probably 15 years ago.
Absolutely. It's a critical factor. And it's one area in which the federal government has really lacked in somehow, you know, issuing policies that would obligate, or if not obligate, ensure that the financial institutions loan money to small and medium enterprises, because those are the ones that really create jobs. And yet, as it is now, a small business, if they get a loan, it's going to be at a rate that would make people, you know, fall into a dead faint in the U.S. You know, they're paying just lots and lots of money for short-term credits here. And that's unfortunate, because that would really – that could push Mexico from the ranks of a middle-developed country growing at 4% to one that might grow at 5, 6%, and that would be transformative for the country.
You haven't been there that long. What's your sense about this so-called normalization of violence that we sometimes hear, you know, that phrase when referring to certain parts of Mexico? Like you mentioned, some places it seems perfectly fine. Other places, violence is the perfectly normal. What is your sense about that among the people, and whether it's something that they accept or don't?
Well, you know, it's hard not to become really inured to it. And I, even as a reporter, I 10, 15 people dead, I don't write the story. I'll let the wire services write it, because it's so common. And I think that people go about their lives, if they're not directly affected, while they don't ignore it, they just, you know, go on about their business. And you take precautions. I have friends in Guadalajara, and they're just trying to adapt to this. The fact that in the last year or so, it's you have roadblocks, so you use Twitter, you know, to find out if there's certain hashtags that you could follow to find out, public security situations, if you're going to be safe. And so people go about adapting they're very resilient in that way. Trying to find out if this is a good idea, can we do this? And you know, they talk to people, and it's just they don't go to traditional media, I think, for this. It's a lot of social media.
It's interesting. When I was watching the film, The Night Watchman, that I spoke about in the last segment, a lot of the sound in the film is radio. And 1 minute they'll be describing weather and that there's violent weather coming, and the civil protection agencies want you to seek cover. And then the next minute they're talking about another 70 beheaded or 50 dead or 15 chopped up. And it's all in the same broadcast.
Yeah. And of course, radio is very important in Mexico, as it is in all of Latin America, far more than perhaps in the U.S. You've got poverty rates here still of 46% to 50%. So it's much easier for those people to have a radio at hand than necessarily have a TV.
And what about Americans there? Are they in any particular danger or increased threat? And I was wondering about you and if you feel any personal danger, if you've ever felt threatened by your reporting.
First of all, on the Americans, we don't really know how many Americans are here in Mexico. There have been estimates of as much as 1 million, mm-hmm. but there's many, many Americans and Canadians, actually, who would come down for 6 months. The Canadians particularly, I think they have this six-month deadline where they have to spend a certain amount of time in Canada to get the health care. About 10 months ago, I was up in the area that's just south of Guadalajara, so Lake Chapala, where is the largest concentration, I think, of expats, of Americans and Canadians. And they're experiencing some more violence in that area, and they're very, concerned about it. But in general, I would say the areas, first of all, I mean, where do American tourists go? They would go to Cancun. Mm-hmm. They might go to see the Mayan pyramids in the Yucatan. They would go to the big beach resorts, Vallarta and, Huatulco and so forth. And those, and of course, Los Cabos in Baja California, those are all pretty safe. In fact, some of them are going to be safer than a large city in the U.S. So I don't think there's, I think tourism can just go ahead and occur. It's areas really off the beaten path where a lot of this occurs. Now, on my own behalf, we all of us foreign reporters have to be careful in reporting here, particularly if we go to border cities, and I mean particularly the Matamoros, Nuevo Laredo, that area that's on the border with Texas.
Where the factories are to be.
There are factories there. Okay. A lot of the factories now are up, on the Arizona-California border,
right.
Mexicali, Tijuana, and also Ciudad Juarez, which is a real success story
mm-hmm.
now in terms of how levels of violence there are coming way down. I saw somebody, some analyst write recently that given its size, New Orleans may have a higher homicide rate soon than Ciudad Juarez, which used to be called Murder City.
Right.
So this, the panorama changes pretty quickly here. We foreign journalists have been largely untouched by this, but of course it's just been a tragedy for Mexican journalists. More than 60 have been killed in the past 6 years, and their deaths, they face threats all the time.
And what sort of things are they reporting that put them in so much danger? Just the news, or is it more investigative type of reporting on the cartels themselves?
Oh, it can vary tremendously. There have been photojournalists killed because they show up at a crime scene if they're covering the police beat, and it's likely they don't go fast, because if you go fast, you're likely to encounter a gangster there or gangsters, and if you do, they will tell you. They may say you can't take a photo of this. Or if you get there after they've left and the police come, the police, especially municipal and state police, are often in cahoots with the gangsters, and so they may get angry over some photograph taken. So it can be as small as that. And in many newsrooms of secondary cities and towns, you'll have people calling into the newsroom saying, hey, you didn't cover the killing of this guy. You know, he's our enemy. Get that in the newspaper. Mm. And so, you know, you get pressure to publish certain things. And then you get other people saying, why did you write this about, you know, what happened? And so people get angry about that. Gangsters get angry. So the pressures come from all sides. And then if you delve into the corruption issue, because this is so intimately related to political corruption, these gangs don't operate in a vacuum here. They're, you know, they've got, you know, ties to all kinds of municipal and state and even federal officials, and they don't want to see their ox gored either.
Is there an ilk in Mexico that is just fed up and that has any power at all?
Yes, there are many people who are fed up. Civil society is growing, and we saw that in the election earlier this year. You know, we had presidential elections in Mexico on July 1st, mm-hmm. and there was a rather spontaneous occurrence in by May and in early June of students marching in Mexico City and other major cities to protest what they saw as media bias. And their real anger was at the very powerful Mexican television monopoly known as Televisa, which is the most powerful Spanish language media conglomerate in the world. And their, you know, their basic argument was, you know, this television network is promoting the man who actually won the elections and will take office December 1st. You know, so while there is kind of a bleak news in this, you know, drumbeat of headlines about beheadings and so forth, yeah, the Mexicans are just, you know, there's many, especially urban professionals and young people and university students who are, you know, they're very eagerly trying to improve the situation. And I think, you know, the trends are good and maybe the medium term. It's going to be very interesting to see how the party coming into power, which held the institutional revolutionary party, held power for in a really a one-party dictatorship for most of the 20th century. They're coming in again, and there's a real pressures to see if they're going to become more democratic. And I think that'll be something we're all going to watch carefully.
Well, Tim Johnson, thanks for talking about it with us today.
Oh, you're welcome, man. Pleasure.
Tim Johnson, he's Mexican City Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers. Coming up, Colonel John Bourne, he's Superintendent for the Ohio State Highway Patrol. We're going to talk about how the issues in Mexico have worked their way up to Ohio. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The next Fresh Air, J.R. Moringer talks about his new novel, Sutton, based on bank robber Willie Sutton, who was a folk hero in an era when the public hated banks.
As good as he was at robbing banks, he was even better at escaping from prison.
Moringer also wrote the best-selling memoir, The Tender Bar. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in just about 15 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Support our station right now and register to win an iPad. Our fall membership drive begins soon, and by making your pledge right now, you'll be automatically entered to win an iPad. No pledge is necessary, and entries are only accepted at WOSU.org. The deadline is October 11th. Thank you for your support of 89.7 NPR News. 66 degrees with rain. Expect showers and thunderstorms today, a high of 74. Support for 89.7 comes from COSI. NPR's Neil Conan hosts Fact, Faith, Science, and Religion, a panel discussion about the intersection of science and religion at COSI on October 11th at 7 p.m. The event is open to the public. More information is available at COSI.org. And support for 89.7 comes from Home Care Assistance, in-home care for older adults with a philosophy of promoting health, well-being, and quality of life for all clients, no matter their limitations. Information on Home Care Assistance is at 481-8888. That's 481-8888. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
In neighboring Mexico, the war against drugs and between the violent cartels is costing tens of thousands of lives, and its influence is being felt as far away as Ohio, where several major interstates serve as drug corridors to Detroit and New York, and where the cartels are literally setting up camp. Joining me now is Colonel John Bourne. He's the superintendent of the Ohio State Highway Patrol. Welcome to the show, John Bourne.
Good morning, and thank you.
So it's not hard to find reference to Ohio slash Mexican cartels, actually. Associated Press reported on August 17th that law enforcement officials say they think a marijuana grow operation discovered in rural southern Ohio could be connected to a Mexican drug cartel. Is that a could be or is it a is? How much do we know about this?
Well, we do know that a lot of the drugs that are being shipped through and to Ohio are coming across the border in the southwest. One of the things that I think we're seeing an increasing amount, not only in 2012, but last year as well, is heroin. Mm-hmm. And much of the heroin that's coming into the United States is coming across the Mexican border. Our troopers here in Ohio and other law enforcement agencies are interdicting it. And in fact, the amount that we're interdicting is staggering. Just this year, we've seized more heroin out of traffic stops in Ohio than we have the 3 years previously combined. And so marijuana, hydroponic marijuana, high-grade marijuana, certainly some of the grow operations in parts of Ohio are probably influenced. But really, what we're seeing as far as the southwest border is heroin, cocaine, and in some cases methamphetamine coming across the border in very large amounts.
And to what extent is it just people transporting versus a real cartel connection at this point?
Well, we do know, based on the cooperation of some of the interdictions that we've done, and in most cases we're interacting with and partnering with the DEA and other federal agencies, and we know that many of these cases are multinational cases, and they are connected to cartels, direct contacts to cartels. Many of the loads that we're interdicting are making sizable impacts with the size of the loads that we're impacting. So we do know there's a connection. It's a direct connection. But sometimes it's difficult to tell because the people transporting it may or may not be major players in the organization. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not.
Exactly. Are you concerned about the transport of the violence as well, or is that not really the concern? It's mostly just stopping the drugs.
Well, it's both. Obviously, officer safety is the number one concern for us, and making sure that our troopers are safe and providing them with intelligence on what the trends are. We are recovering weapons out of a lot of these traffic stops, although the bulk seizures, the very large seizures, we don't always see weapons involved. Sometimes they're very powerful weapons, but most cases where we're getting sizable loads, there is a escort vehicle with that load that's designed not only to protect the load, but to protect from theft of that load. And sometimes that car or that other vehicle, the trail vehicle or the lead vehicle, doesn't stop during the traffic stop, which obviously we're very concerned with. But you're talking about millions of dollars. Last year alone, just our agency, Ohio Troopers, seized almost $70 million worth of drugs off of traffic stops. We're up 26% above that this year. We probably will be over $100 million worth of drugs, and obviously people want to protect that investment, whether it's a legitimate or illegitimate business. And in this case, violence is certainly a possibility.
Now, you're just talking about Ohio alone.
Just Ohio.
Yeah, I was reading an article from online, it's called businessinsider.com, and it noted that the Gulf cartel spreads out east of Texas, making appearances in cities from Columbus to Raleigh, North Carolina. And where the real cluster is in Ohio, though, when they talk about the invasion of the drug cartels, is right down at the, you know, the borders where Indiana, Ohio, and Kentucky meet. And I'm wondering how much the states work together on these interdictions.
Well, we have a partnership with all the states that surround Ohio. It's actually called the Six State Trooper Project. But the both intelligence sharing and information sharing, as well as operational partnerships with all those states is ongoing. In fact, we have operations going on this weekend. We share information from traffic stops across the United States because we know both at the federal level and based on what the other state agencies and agencies across the country are telling us, what the primary routes of travel are and what the major shipment routes are. These are essentially businesses, although illegitimate businesses, that are shipping large amounts of product, and they're very good at it, and they're very adaptable. And so it doesn't just stop at Ohio's border. Ohio is a key state because of our transportation routes, because of the interstates, the north and south and east and west routes. It's very difficult to get to major population centers in the United States without going through Ohio. And so although we're pretty far removed from the southwest border, we're certainly a key area, a key distribution area for illegal narcotics.
When I was speaking with Tim Johnson earlier, he's the Mexico City Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers, he said one of the problems that the military in Mexico has in terms of working on this problem and fighting the cartels is that they're not trained to collect evidence. They're not trained to aid in any kind of prosecution. And I was wondering, you know, obviously the Highway Patrol is, but who do you prosecute? Are you just, how far, how deep can you go in prosecution when you are dealing with these relatively small, small operators working for the cartels?
Well, it depends on the load, and it depends on the individual type of drug that we're seizing. Sometimes it is lower level players, and other times it's not. Fortunately, we have really strong partnerships with some of our federal agencies, including the DEA and the FBI. And in many cases, if this moves outside the borders of Ohio, or the people cooperate, and in many cases they do cooperate, and we turn them over to DEA. You see, I would say, a significant number of our seizures going into federal prosecution because the DEA is then working it beyond the borders of Ohio and in many cases working other people associated with that organization or that load. So in some cases, we're getting a low-level courier. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, we're getting people that are a little bit higher in the organizational chain.
But does it ever go international? Okay.
Yes.
And also, when you're talking about the couriers and whoever you're catching at this, are they necessarily Mexicans? Are Americans starting to get involved, or do they tend to be not only Mexicans but Mexicans who are here illegally?
That's an excellent question. And what we found is because these organizations are fairly successful in what they do, they're very adaptable. And in fact, if our troopers are looking for a particular type of person or vehicle, they're going to be largely unsuccessful. They're moving it from both the type of person and the type of vehicle and the times of day and the routes that they're moving it. And that's why intelligence or information that you're sharing with other law enforcement across the United States and outside the United States is so critical. And so we've had Caucasian grandparents that are from Texas. We've had young couples that are college students. And obviously we've had people that may be Mexican nationals. So it really, as diverse as Ohio is, as diverse as who travels Ohio's highways, is who's, in many cases, hauling these drugs.
And we were talking last week about Appalachia and the prescription drug problem in Appalachia. They've shut down a lot of those pill mills now, and a lot of the addicts are turning to the heroin, the cheap heroin that comes from Mexico. Is that where a lot of it's headed, or where do we know where they're taking it? Are they just shooting it up to Michigan, and this is the only way to get there, or what?
Well, we are still seeing a lot of pill seizures. In fact, some of the higher-end pill seizures, such as ecstasy, is coming across, believe it or not, the Canadian border and into the United States and then through and to Ohio. Heroin is moving both through and to Ohio and to our population centers, but it's also moving to Detroit, Chicago, New York. And I don't know if that's a specific answer to your question, but really there is no specific point that these pills are moving to. We have had a significant increase in the or significant success in shutting down some of the pill mills, as they've been called, in southern Ohio, and I think we've made a really big impact. In fact, I was just recently meeting with some of our federal partners, and we know just from the interdictions that we're doing that some of these couriers and organizations are now avoiding Ohio. They're going down through Indiana and around Ohio to states such as West Virginia or Kentucky, to avoid interdiction efforts in Ohio. So we are making an impact, but many of the pills are still coming from the Michigan area and moving towards and through southern Ohio into West Virginia.
I would imagine West Virginia and Kentucky don't have the resources Ohio has.
Well, those two states are actually working with us in sharing information. But Kentucky State Police, I know, and West Virginia State Police have been very active. In fact, West Virginia has been up working with us on some joint drug interdiction efforts along the highways. Many of the drugs that used to come up through Florida have been impacted by interdiction efforts along I-75. So we are making a dent. We are impacting it. But obviously, one of the downsides of that is that if you're an addict and you can find something cheaper, that heroin is a cheaper alternative at this point.
Everyone's been facing, I mean, I know that you took big cuts in the budget a few years ago. I don't see that changing anytime soon necessarily. How do you prioritize when it comes to these kinds of operations? How do you know where to put your money?
We did a couple things. We did take a reduction, actually an $11 million reduction as an agency over the last, just the biennium alone. But we reallocated a lot of our resources and priorities, and we really have two key functions within our agency. One is traffic safety, reducing the number of people killed on our highways. And two is looking beyond the traffic stop for criminal activity. Last year, the safest year ever in Ohio's history, and we also had the largest amount of drugs seized in our history. And it's really hand in hand. When you pass a trooper, you see a trooper and there's blue lights on the highway, you may assume that the person may be getting a speeding ticket. And that's something that obviously benefits traffic safety because you may slow down even temporarily, but it changes your behavior. But then that traffic stop allows us to look beyond the traffic stop to determine whether or not there's other illegal activity going on. And really, that is the key with the allocation of our resources. We've done some other things that organizationally, internally. We've shrunk our staff at the top and tried to reinvest at the trooper level. We've added some additional canines. And in February, the governor announced the new pound 677 toll-free number. We're getting almost 5,000 calls per month on that number from the public. We've had seizures as big as 32 kilos of cocaine as a result of that number.
I was going to ask you how much the public just generally is involved when it comes to this.
They actually are very involved. From people that are driving down the road and seeing someone snorting or smoking something, obviously that's a clue. But to answer the question, resources are obviously thin, and that's why we need the public's help. This toll-free number has been extremely helpful and probably a major reason of why we've seen an increase this year, because troopers are able to, when someone says that you see someone snorting something with a rolled up dollar bill in a car next to you, we're going to make it a priority to get a trooper there. And sometimes that user is also a courier.
Well, thanks for joining us today to talk about this.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
It's Colonel John Bourne. He's superintendent for the Ohio State Highway Patrol. I just want to let you know, to our listeners, you can listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher weekdays from 10 a.m. to noon for a show focused on all the issues and events that shape life in Central Ohio. Be sure to like us on Facebook, follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides, and you can follow me, Ann, on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. The staff includes associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Corinne Gleckler, production assistants Katie Higgins and Leticia Wiggins, and volunteer Rose Joe. Thanks for listening to All Sides today. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.